Australia is getting drier and drier. More dams will not make for more rainfall. There are all of these things that need to be discussed. So if you'd like to join us in the conversation, 1-300-800-222 or text 0437-774-774. Simon Toes is from the Sustainable Cities Senior Research Scientist with CSIRO and is with us this morning. Hi, Simon.
Good morning, Trevor.
Simon, is it something that has been recognised for a long time that we need to take a close look at how we manage water in Australia? And if that's the case, are we doing better than we were maybe 20, 30 years ago?
Sure. The Millennium Drought certainly was a big wake-up call for the country. Before then, we really sort of coasted, and then we realised that we were overdoing things. And I think in the time since the Millennium Drought, we had some relapses in some areas, particularly our cities, but we know that some areas, particularly out west in our farms, have just remained particularly dry. And there's been a lot of work being done by a lot of different agencies, both government and non-government, to find ways that we can do things better and differently.
Many people say that it's a cyclic thing, that Australia goes through droughts, that we'll continue going through droughts. But it is it more than just a cyclic thing?
Okay, it depends on... Australia is a very big country, as we, and it's a continent, as we know, and it depends on where you're at. So at the moment, what we have is that the east coast of Australia, down through to South Australia, is... does go through natural variable cycles, and that's continuing at the moment and will continue for the foreseeable future. And predicting that is particularly difficult. In the west, we are seeing a naturally drying cycle that is continuing, and that's not a cycle, that's just continuing drying. What is happening, though, is that's been overlaid at the moment by warming, increasing warming through the initial stage of, not initials, but the continuing climate change, which is just increasingly getting more of a problem. And at a certain time, and the models are suggesting around about 2030 at the moment, that we'll see a tipping point for a lot of Australia where climate change will start to impact on that natural variability, and it will just get a lot more periods of drying interspersed with fewer rain cycles, which may be more severe, but that's hard to predict at the moment.
So people that say that this is just a natural cycle, that we go through droughts, that it's got nothing to do with climate change, in some ways they're right. However, there are the natural cycles, but they're impacted in a greater degree because of climate change.
That's correct. So it's a natural cycle, but climate change is slowly starting to have effect. At the moment, it's mostly around temperature, which will affect things like soil moisture and evaporation rates. But in a few decades, we'll start to see that rainfall patterns are also seriously impacted by climate change.
Can I just clear something up? Because a lot of people will say that, and I don't want to get stuck in a climate change conversation. However, people will say that we're in particularly cold spell at the moment with all of this cold weather, that it just goes to show that there's no such thing as climate change because it's associated with warmth. Can you quickly explain why that is?
Not very easily, but it's part of, again, that natural variability that we're experiencing. That, you know, people say, oh, it's a really cold spell, but if you go back through the records, you can see that those cold spells appear every now and then, which is part of that natural cycle. And but even those cold spells are not as cold as what has been experienced previously.
If you'd like to join us as we take a look at water as a precious resource in Australia and how we maintain it, 1-300-800-222 is the number to call, or text us 0437-774-774. I'll go to calls in a second. I just wanted to ask you firstly about the Murray-Darling, Simon, because that is always brought to the fore as far as water management is concerned and whether or not it's done particularly well. Just your thoughts?
Well, the Murray-Darling system is one of those major catchment areas globally, if you like, where a large amount of agricultural production occurs. And so what's happened historically is a lot of water has been allocated for agriculture, and particularly during the Millennium Drought, it was starting to be realised that too much had been done. So now what they're trying to do is balance what is enough, and The difficulty is that in a variable climate, enough is hard to predict. And it's also noted that we need to protect the environment more than we've been doing. And it's getting that balance for what can the environment take in the Murray-Darling, what can the environment and the ecology take, and how little, if you like, and how much can go to agriculture, and what's that balance? And they're working hard on that, but it's not an easy answer. It's not an easy answer at all.
I guess the point is, will there ever be enough to be able to sustain both?
I think that's something. There can be lots of water through, and there probably can be a balance, and in some places they're getting a balance that's starting to improve. So they talk about some icon sites, and some of those icon sites where water has been saved for those icon sites is you're seeing improvements. Are we back to what it should be? That's debatable by some, but that's also can lead to some stresses with some farmers and some farming communities.
We'll take lots of calls. Lots of people wanting to join us. Uncle, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What did you want to say?
Oh, this land is a great land, but it's the driest continent on the planet. And it's time we woke up that water is the most precious thing on this planet. And it's a shame that we are misusing this great, great thing that we have. You know, our indigenous families have been mastering it for thousands of years. But we come along, you Europeans have come to this land and they've farmed, over-farmed, they're overused, over-mining. I come from Alice Springs and I had to move to a big city because of health reasons, but I've watched springs disappear and all that stuff. And it's a shame that we don't wake up that the economy of this land is water, land and food.
Uncle, thank you. I'll go back to Simon. Simon, is that one of the things that we read to realise is just how precious water is in this country and whether or not we treat it with the respect that we deserve?
Sure.
It deserves?
And that goes both for our cities and our rural areas. Our cities, we have that tendency to use water and just throw it away, and it's discharged to the nearest ocean, bay, instead of bringing it back in and circularising that as much as possible, what we call the circular economy. We need to change from a more European-style farming practice in a lot of areas and question, do we farm certain things in certain areas or do we change crops? And to be frank, some technologies are starting to come through, sensor technology and automation, which will help farmers to work out or have the potential to help farmers work out how much water can be applied along with nutrients, fertilizer and other things. So you're applying the right amounts, not too much or too little, which will actually give the optimum crops being brought in for the amount of water that's available and being able to rotate and choose different crops. We need to be smarter how we use water in Australia.
Is one of the things that when you're taking a look at sustainability and water, also population, because quite a few people sending texts in saying one of the things that's never looked at is increasing population growth.
Yeah, that's a really difficult one to answer because again, in our cities, and most of our populations in our cities, we could probably get away with using a lot more water if we brought water into a circular economy. So water, we're doing research in an urban area at the moment, how much water can we recycle back and how little water we have to start using that's coming from our rivers. We could capture water that at the moment runs off when it does rain. Can we capture that and reuse it instead of it running down the creeks, which actually causes ecological damage at the moment because we've got, when it does rain, too much water running into our creeks and streams. Can we recycle our wastewater instead of throwing it away, which is a benefit both for the environments that currently receive our wastewater and bringing that water back into the environment. Once you start doing that in an urban, then you can start looking at what farmers and others need to do who are in a more difficult situation because they've got less capability to circularise that water economy that we can in cities.
Paul, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Trevor. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
Mate, we've had over 200 years of white settlement here. We've over-cultivated, we've over-chopped down every tree that we can find, over-glazed, overstocked. Why doesn't somebody get off their backside, like the government and the state governments working together, cleaning out all these creeks and riverbeds? All you got to do is do a core sample in some of these creeks and riverbeds, and it'll tell you exactly what's been going on over the last 200-odd years.
So, I mean, it's as Paul points out, it's been an issue for a long time and will continue to be an issue until governments start to do something about it.
Yeah. It's a balancing act that I think governments struggle with already in the fact that with agriculture and Brit does bring in a significant proportion of money into the economy. How much more can we do that or should we start to move away from agriculture? What can replace it for jobs in the economy? Do we go to a service economy? But at the moment, it's widely acknowledged that we can't continue doing things the way we are. And the question is how we change back and change habits of old, change to new. And that brings in a whole lot of social context and it's not an easy answer, but it's certainly something that I think is acknowledged that we do need to do.
I mean, so basically it's an electoral issue. I mean, a while ago when we saw water prices go up because there was going to be a lack of water, where we were told that we had to ration, that we could water our gardens every second day, which was introduced by government, that's when we started to see change in water habits.
Yeah, and people seeing the fact that their reservoirs and dams were drying out to 10% and 15%. That's in the city, and then in the rural areas, people started to see creeks and rivers run dry because of over-extraction, so too many people, not individuals, but too many farms and areas removing water, and when it doesn't rain, that water doesn't come in. And it gets difficult because when it does rain, then there needs to be bring back this balancing of creating water for the environment. And so naturally people see water flowing down a river and say, well, why can't we take some of that? But you need to save some of that. So there's the additional stresses. That all needs to be balanced. And that's a new paradigm of how we do this, which needs to be different from how things are done in other countries where in Europe and other places where farming is very different and they're starting to have to change as well. So it's not just Australia.
Keith, good morning.
Hi. Hey, gang. My little question is about the peak of water. Just like peak oil, there's only a certain amount of water in the world. So has anyone done any studies of how many human beings can be managed? Like we've got 8 billion at the moment. How many people can we cope with the water resources, fresh water resources that we've got?
And that would include aquifers, I presume, as well, Simon?
Yeah. Well, water is water, and one of the things that often people, and when I talk to school students, I remind them that water that we drink today has passed through the kidneys of multiple millions of dinosaurs, so they get an understanding that water doesn't change. That said, it's quite the call-in was quite correct. Water is a very precious resource, which we need to work out how much we use. But water is just one part of the sustainability of the planet in general. And we're already past that. And each year we pass the sustainability of the planet to hold just the population. So, again, that's a global issue of just what do we do? And some of that can be brought back by being more intelligent with what we do with all the resources. But at a certain point, there will be a tipping point where the planet will no longer be able to cope with the number of people and the way we live.
Neil, good morning.
Good morning. How are you going?
Good, Neil.
Look, I think I saw it on Landline the other day that who actually owns Australia's stored water resources. I saw a thing about that it's owned by overseas, a lot of it's owned by overseas trading companies.
Oh, now this is to do with, yeah. So, Simon, there are water allotments and water allocations, and it's almost become a commodity and this can be bought and sold, Simon.
Yeah, so there's a thing called the water market. And so water that flows down, particularly in the Murray-Darling system, it operates. And so those who have a license or an ability to extract water from the rivers. So when water exists in an aquifer or a river, it belongs to the Crown. And then the governments then allocate licenses to extract the water. So you don't own the water, you own the right to extract the water. And but what the water market allows people to do, so a farmer, for example, who says, well, I don't need as much water, or I'm not going to grow a certain crop this year because I don't think it's a good year to grow that crop, I'm allowed to lay fallow. What they can do is actually sell the water, their water right, on the water market, and that can be bought by others. And again, it's a big debate because it's not just farmers that are in the market, but it is the people who come in to speculate, and that needs to be looked at. Is it, and I know there is a study at the moment being done through the Murray-Darling Basin, which is due later this year, just, you know, what is the role of that, and is that sustainable? Is that workable? Do we bring it back just to farmers only can work on it? Being aware that water is also being bought back by government for the environment in that water market as well.
Can that be unscrambled, though? Can we actually take that market away? Can we bring it back to farmers and the people that are actually using the water and stop it being used as a speculative resource?
I'm not fully aware of how the water market is currently being run or how it could be changed, but I do understand that the government, through the Murray-Darling Basin Authority and others, is actually looking at the structure of the water market at the moment. And so I'm assuming from that they may tweak it or change it as they see from this review from about 10 years worth of the water market.
Gary, good morning.
Good morning. Look, it's been said before, but the Ord River, you know, a pipeline down into the centre of Australia, and they have a huge market garden there. I know it's going to cost a lot of money, but you could redirect foreign aid to pay for it. The Chinese would have it built now.
I've got another text here, and this has been spoken about a lot. I mean, since the 30s, I think, Simon, build a pipeline from the north to collect wet season water. That's something that's been spoken about for a long time, as I said, probably since the 40s or 30s, Simon.
Yeah. The one thing we've got to remember is we're on a ball. There is no down, so water is not going to flow. So we can, and the Chinese do it, but they're doing it in a different manner. We could pipe and pump water anywhere we wanted to, should we want to, but you know, the comment there, foreign aid, well, it would cost significantly more than all the foreign aid that we do, and we would have to forego other things. What do we want to forego? Hospitals, schools, roads, because the amount of money to pump water long distances is excessively high. So a study was done for shipping water from the Ord River down to Perth, and it was calculated that it would, the energy alone, not even the cost of setting up a system and then the cost of pumping, but the energy of pumping water from the north of Western Australia to Perth alone was 2.5 times the energy of desalinating the same amount of water. And when you consider urban potable water is our most expensive water at the moment, our most valuable water, you can just start to look at how much that would cost the nation. So you can do anything of those things you want to, but what is else that we want to give up in the process just because of the cost is astronomical.
And that doesn't even take into account the amount of water that could be lost for various reasons and all sorts of things. That's just the energy itself.
That's right. And then the study, which 2.5 times, was an open channel rather than a pipes, because water doesn't flow. It's very viscous. So they were looking at an open channel rather than a pipe. And it was cheaper in an open channel to set up. And they calculated there'd be massive amounts of evaporation. And with climate change and increasing heat, we'd lose even more water.
Because people have pointed to the pumping of water from Mundaring to Kalgoorlie as an example of how it's done, but that's only 500 k's, I guess.
Yeah, and that was set up over 100 years ago when it was a lot cheaper to do those sorts of things. Now, longer distances and the cost would be significantly higher.
Lynn, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Why not forego submarines and put that money into pumping water from the Gulf?
I mean, that's, I guess, the point that you're making, Simon, is that, yes, it's possible, but what are you prepared to forego? And I don't know if governments would forego defence budgets to be able to do that. Some people might say it would be better, but whether or not they choose to do it's another question.
Yeah, well, that's a government and a society question. And again, you could consider something like pumping that amount of water would cost an inordinate of a large proportion of our defence budget every year. And that we put a lot in defence, but it's probably defence and more.
Because Bert has actually said, what about, because the Bradfield scheme is, I presume, part of that whole idea, and that includes the same thing?
Yes.
Thank you, Bert. George, good morning.
Hi, Trevor and Simon. I'm a great believer in water divining for locating small streams under the ground on blocks, you know, out in the country. My granddad used to do water divining. A piece of stick in your hand, a Y-shaped piece of stick or a piece of wire for locating small streams under the ground on country blocks.
Yeah, George, we've done a whole program on water divining. So, Simon, we don't necessarily have to go into that, but how much time is spent, whether it through water divining or otherwise, are we seeing exploration done for new sources of water?
Well, that's so water divining, or however you else you want to look at it, with modern technology, you know, we're going into aquifers. And so aquifer is an area underground which stores what we call productive water. So you can actually put a bore down and you can pull water out. And yes, you can get that water, but that water comes from the surface at some stage. It may be only a few years ago or up to thousands of years ago. And you can essentially mine that water. Your groundwater levels will drop, and in a changing climate, a variable climate, we can do, you can very quickly overpump that water. In some places, in some aquifers, if you overpump it, the ground will literally collapse, will sink, and it's happening around the world. It sinks, and once it sinks, that ground cannot take that water back again. And if you've got a lot of ecosystems actually will be fed by that groundwater, so come through. And so if you overpump the groundwater, your ecosystems will be damaged and could be irreversibly damaged. So again, it's something we have to be very careful about and not just totally rely on groundwater. It's a precious resource like the water that flows through our streams. And we need to be very careful about how we allocate that water and use it.
So that's one of the reasons we don't muck around too much with the Artesian Basin.
Yeah. Some of that water in the Artesian Basin has been estimated to be hundreds of thousands to possibly even millions of years old, and has come from up in the Gulf or even from Papua New Guinea and flowed underground through down to areas. And there have been areas where it's been overpumped or bores, and groundwater levels drop, and even farmers have to put even deeper bores down. Ecosystems are damaged. Again, it's something we have to be very careful of and not just rush into as a new source to replace an old source that we can't use anymore, not changing those other practices, doing farming different ways, working our water through our cities in different ways.
I mean, that's what we hear with the whole energy question is, okay, if we haven't got enough energy, we need to make more energy. Do we need to move away from that? And instead of saying we need to find more water, we need to somehow make more water, that we need to be taking a look at the way we use it instead?
Yeah. So a lot of our cities exist on the coast. We could desalinate a lot more water, and that's the making water. We're taking salt water and producing fresh water, so just removing the salt. So we're not making more new water. We can't make new water, but what we can do is use a water source that is much more plentiful but very, very salty. Again, that's very expensive to do. It uses a lot of energy. That's less of an ability as you get away from the coast. So you can, again, it comes to that point of producing water at the coast and then pumping it long distances just doesn't work. So again, we need to think about how the best way is to think What are we doing with our water at the moment? In our city, we use our water once and we throw it away. It's causing ecological damage by being discharged out into oceans and rivers, where we could actually beneficially bring that water and cycle it through our environment for multiple purposes. And that allows us to use less water than it is in our rivers. So we're, our local rivers around our cities benefit. And the same then, can we change the way we farm? Can we be smarter with how we farm and use water, using automation and new technologies? Can we use less water for the same benefit? And therefore, we're actually getting the benefits there, and production is the same, and we actually make money and spend less money.
I mean, in a city, stop hogging water, then it makes more water available for people in regional and farming areas as well.
In those farming areas and regions that are either close to the city or connected to the same river system that feeds a city, yeah. But it's not going to... So changing Sydney's water use, for example, or Brisbane or Melbourne's water use patterns is not going to help people, farmers out in the Murray-Darling, for example.
Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Tom.
Complex topic, and the approach of everyone oversimplifies everything, but you... could say that there is this interconnectedness between water, energy and people, and everything is energy. And to make the most efficient use of energy, because the contradiction here is that politicians talk about, and people talk about reducing carbon emissions, yet on the other hand, everyone's has this economy that increases consumption. So you can't rely upon politicians and people who have vested interest without really understanding the basis of what they're trying to achieve. And then you bring it back to water and you say, well, how are we going to make the best use of water? If, unless you know the interconnected nature of nitrogen and carbon with water, you cannot make the most use of water in the most efficient manner, which really comes back to this, how do we store water? And something that's not really considered is there is certainly opportunity to divert water from rainfall back into the aquifers. That can be done. That's one method of storing it without evaporation, because where I am, the evaporation rate of stored water, and stored water is the most efficient, is very energy efficient for food production, is about 2.5 metres per annum of just surface evaporation out of the dam.
So you're talking about dams, Tom. So what you're saying is instead of storing water in dams, return it to the aquifer and then take it from there.
No, well, that's oversimplifying it again, because there's all of these things that have to be done to be energy efficient, because when you look at the landscape, the way that the landscape, the land is being treated, water is not recycling the way that it used to. So because there's been a change in vegetation, there's been a change in soil structure, there's been an increase in runoff, there's more water going out, there's more silt being created. So you simply cannot approach water in a simplistic manner. You must understand the complete cycle, and to understand the complete cycle, I could say to you, we have an abattoir in our local area that's about to be built. They export all the offal, they can't use it, so they send it away to Brisbane and it ends up being used in rose gardens. You could take that offal, convert it into chicken food, use stored water to convert the chicken manure into local food production in the form of vegetables. You go to Bourke, where they had water buybacks, so there's no stored water for local food production. And this is oversimplifying the matter again.
Okay, Tom, we just need to bed it down to a one-sentence point.
The point is you need to understand the interconnected nature of energy and water and people before you can start pinpointing exactly the best way to use water.
Simon?
Yeah, so that's a very good point, because that falls under what is called the food, energy, water, and now food, energy, water, waste nexus. And it's a very good point that we have traditionally compartmentalized all our different parts of what our environment. So as I said, energy here, water here, nutrients over there. In fact, it's a cycle that is all interconnected, and it's what we call a systems approach. And it's time that understanding how everything works together will go a long way to helping us be more sustainable with what we want to do. It's a very good point. And I mean, yes, we can store water underground. It's called Managed Aquifer Recharge, and we've done research on that. Again, you have to have the right aquifer in the right place. And so there is, again, you can't oversimplify that. But where it works, it can work very well. But in other places, there's not a suitable aquifer to store in, and we need to think of something else.
John, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Gentlemen, a number of previous speakers have touched on the matter, but I've only touched on the periphery of it. Firstly, as has been mentioned, there is no new water. We have just as much water today as we had millions of years ago. The problem is us, people. We build on the arable land, and then we try and convert what are basically deserts into arable land. I mean, that is just ludicrous. The reality of it is, until such time as we have a balance, which means something like, oh, I hate this word, but it's a word that needs to be used, until we have something like culling of the population, or at least slowing down the growth of the population, we are going to have what is purported to be water problems. And we don't have water problems. What we have is a population problem.
I know we covered population just a little while ago, but one of the things that John brings up there, Simon, as well as population, it's where the population lives and how it's dispersed, and whether or not we move away from a city structure that we have now, which is very unlikely. But is the dispersal of population an issue within itself?
It could be, or if we were clever, and if we are clever, it could actually be a benefit, because at the moment we have what's called the urban sprawl, and that's, it was a very good point made. We are spreading, our cities are spreading out and taking what was previously arable land that was farms, but we could do different ways of farming. So starting to see developments in what we call vertical farming now. And then, you know, old areas in cities are becoming farms. Can areas in cities become viable areas to grow crops, you know, or vegetables and the like? And again, we love our quarter-acre block, our picket fence in Australia, but, you know, can we change to reducing the size of our cities, either our existing cities to contract back in and a bit and more dense living, which actually ecologically has been shown to be beneficial for the country, or if we encourage people to move into new places in the regions, we could, again, create cities that are much, much better designed for people without actually using extremely large areas of space that could be used for other things.
Or do we move, as we start, probably with the Gascoigne food bowl, do we move our production of food to the areas where there are more water, but then we then have to take a look at how we distribute those products from there?
Yeah, and so that's a distribution problem. And again, you'd have to be very careful about, are you putting food production into an area where you're just creating the same problem that you've had elsewhere, that we've created elsewhere? Are we just shifting the problem? So we can do these things. We can move to new places up in northern Australia, develop those areas that are currently not used, and the whole of northwest Australia is going to become wetter. We can move them there, but again, such a large continent, moving things around is going to have to be considered. Can we do, and with automation, automated transport, we may be able to do that. It may be cheaper to move things by drones or other things. That's something that we need to look at in the future.
If you'd like to join us as we take a look at water, how we use it, how we can better use it, and the things that do association, even with farming, 1300 and within cities, 1300 800 222.
The Soweto Gospel Choir, winner of the 2019 Grammy Award for Best World Music for their latest album, Freedom, will bring their concert to Australia. Uplifting and joyous, the choir will perform a rousing program of freedom songs. Don't miss the spectacular, award-winning Soweto Gospel Choir. For tour and album details, visit abc.net.au/abcevents.
Simon Toews is a Sustainable Cities Senior Research Scientist with the CSIRO as we take a look at water. A text here, Simon, that says, it's not just farming. Underground mining is water intensive. We need to rethink and rebalance the industry supporting the economy with the needs of the community. Things are out of kilter.
Yeah, mines do both use large amounts of water, and they do impact impact on, by their nature, do in fact impact on groundwater resources to keep open cut and below ground mines dry. Often they pump large amounts of water out. If they stop in places, these large voids become very large lakes. And fortunately, that water then sometimes becomes very acidic in other parts. So thinking about how we mine, where that water is taken to is a difficult thing. So at the moment, a lot of the coal seam gas extracts large amounts of water out to extract the coal seam gas out, and they have to treat that water and put it back into the aquifers where possible, or treat. Sometimes that water can be put into rivers to bring down, but again, you've got to look at your groundwater resources, and again, it comes back to a balancing act to look at effectively where is that balance, where can we do something that is beneficial from production of a mineral or a resource and not over damage a vital resource like our water supplies.
I just wanted to clear up something. So a few people wanting to ask the question, if we get rid of farms, then what are we going to do, buy food from elsewhere? You're not saying that we get rid of farms, it's just taking a look at farming practices, of which a lot of farmers are doing anyway.
Absolutely. By no ways would we stop farming. It's too important to the economy. It's too important to the population. But as you just pointed out, it's looking at it in a different way. So moving away from the traditional European-style farming to ways that we use technology better, putting the correct type of crop in the correct area, and doing things differently.
And farmers are looking at those sorts of things all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
They're very aware.
Yeah.
Gerald, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Look, yeah, I'm calling from Western Australia, as you probably know. Now, it's perfectly obvious to me, and I should imagine most of the people who think that way, that we're surrounded by water. You can't destroy water. You can only pollute it. However, it all comes from evaporation. Now, in Western Australia, our dams haven't overflowed for years, and we have got desalinators to get ourselves out of the problem. Now, all we need to do is desalinate the water, and by using our technology that we've got today, such as solar power and wind power, to generate the power to desalinate the water. And we would always have a water supply because it's there, it's all around us, and it just comes from the sky onto the ground, back into the ground and out of the ground with evaporation when it gets to the surface, and so it just goes around in circles. So let's get on the circuit of developing desalination.
Simon, is that one of the things that you mentioned, how it's not environmentally friendly in a lot of ways because of the amount of energy that's used to desalinate? Are they taking a look, or is there a close look being taken in how to desalinate in a better way so that we don't use as much energy?
Sure. As was just pointed out, we can use renewable energy. So really, desalination is not necessarily environmentally unfriendly because you're taking seawater, there's lots of seawater, and you're just removing the salt. You've got to be careful where the salt goes back to. That's the pollution problem. You've got to be careful there. It's really the cost and the pollution from the current energy that sources that we're using. So are we using a lot of coal-fired energy, non-renewable energy sources to desalinate the water? That's the issue. But if you've got wind and solar energy, then sure, you can do that. That's fine for our coastal communities. As soon as you move inland, then it comes back to that part. How far are we prepared to pump water? And so desalination will has a potential to help our major cities, but not necessarily an area such as the Murray-Darling or one of those other areas. That said, there's also technologies coming through with new ways of different membranes which use less energy, which, if come true, could make major changes. But again, mostly the way they work, probably in our urban environments, again, less, more for our rural areas which need large amounts of water, and not with the cost of producing the water, desalinated water. Again, farming work very close margins with their water, and the cost of desalinating is just too expensive for farmers to afford.
David, good morning.
Good morning, Jens. Simon, harvesting water using common sense on government projects. Long time ago, I was a committee member on the Lane Cove Tunnel. It only took me 5 minutes to convince the Lane Cove Tunnel people to take the water which flow, the inflows, the Lane Cove Tunnel, this is New South Wales, dives, and it's diving under Stringy Bar Creek, which feeds into the Lane Cove River. That water is actually treated, and there's 11 litres per second that comes out of it. And it took me, as I say, 5 minutes to convince the engineering people there, and it took me another almost 3 years to convince the government to come up with the funds of just taking water from a holding tank to irrigate an athletic field, which it does now, has done for years.
David, thank you. I'm just mindful because the news is coming up, and we're not going to be able to get to everybody this morning. Simon, the idea of harvesting water, there are a lot of different ways of harvesting water. I've got a text here that says from rainwater tanks to stormwater runoff. You mentioned the idea of the circulation of water. There's so much water wasted that goes through our cities as far as stormwater runoff is concerned, and we've known that for a long time. Why is it that we don't see more work done as far as stormwater and as far as other ways of harvesting water?
As it starts to get dry, I think you're going to see people do that. But the trouble is, as has been pointed out before, we only do that in times of crisis, and times of crisis when it dries up, and then there's less stormwater and rainwater to use, and that's the big problem. Whereas what we need to be doing is using our water and working out ways to use our water in general more efficiently through the systems. And where possible, where we've created something like this tunnel and we have water that's just flowing out, can we capture that water that would just be thrown away and use it for something productive? Keeping in mind that sometimes, like if you're going under a creek or something, that water is probably coming originally from the creek. Are you impacting the creek? Do we need to return that water that's in the tunnel back to the creek for ecological purposes? Again, it comes to that balancing act. Where is the water coming from? What are we using it for? Are we using it for something that's beneficial or something we need, or are we just wasting that water?
Does the individual, like the everyday person who has water tanks being servicing their homes, does that make a big difference?
It can if the tanks are connected up to the household. I have it here in my house, and I have used significantly less water than in the neighbouring surrounds of people that don't have it connected up to the house water, because it's connected up to my washing machine and my toilet systems and the likes. There's been studies shown that if you have tanks that are not connected up to the household, it doesn't really change how much drinking water or potable water gets used. So we need to be able to redo to connect up rainwater tanks into the house for it to be effective.
Peter, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, Pete.
I meant to say garden water, not rushing everybody on even days, but even day use for recreation use gardens, domestic gardens, so you don't water the concrete path.
Oh, so this comes back to the whole idea of rationing water and us treating it with a greater respect, Simon.
Yeah, so again, in a lot of places in Australia, we've had what's called demand management. And part of that demand management is you can only water on certain times of the day or certain days. And in some cities at the moment, that comes in when water levels and dams drop below certain areas. In other areas like Perth, it's a permanent thing. And I think that's a mindset that people in cities could save significant water just by simple things like just not turning on the tap on the sprinklers and walking away. Can you have a timer on your tap? Can you have a rainwater tank to irrigate? Can you capture some of the water that goes down the sink and use that for irrigating your pot plants and the likes? Simple things can actually save thousands of litres of water a year. And if everybody in a city does that, then that's massive savings.
A couple of techs saying, why not just build more dams?
Well, you have to have a dam in a place where it actually works, and dams only work if there's water flowing down a river. And if you're going to dam, as has happened in places, if you create a new dam, maybe somebody downstream gets less water. So again, it's a trade-off of what are you going to do? And again, that is, to my mind, coming back to that previous call, a simple approach that doesn't look at the whole cycle and doesn't think for the future what we should be doing rather than what is the easy way to do things.
Then what should we be doing? What are the things that should be happening? And through research, what's being looked at?
as I said, that water cycle in cities is being looked at significantly, and I think our cities will become more and more water wise and water sensible, capturing and slowing down water, what is used called water sensitive urban design. The Chinese actually call it a sponge city, so the cities slow down water and capture water and use it around, which means that cities become more a part of the local environment rather than a sink for things and discharging just waste. And again, being more sensible, helping farmers to look at new ways to use water is being looked at and will continue to be looked at.
And within that, to recognise that, that drought occurs and to also work out what is sustainable in certain areas as well as far as farming practices are concerned too.
Yes. So when I do presentations overseas, I always quote a little bit of Dorothy McKellar's "A Sunburnt I Love a Sunburnt Country," you know, a land of drought and flooding rains. And we've got to realise that that is the natural system of Australia, and we need to work with it rather than work against it. But at the same time, we have to recognise that that is a changing climate now through climate change, and we need to very quickly learn how to deal with that as well.
It's been great talking to you this morning, Simon. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Simon Toews, Sustainable Cities Senior Research Scientist with the CSIRO.